Well, let's resume the proceedings this morning. Begin by making an announcement for all of you to mark on your social calendar. The commission is having a reception at its offices here in Anchorage after the hearings adjourn this afternoon. So after we have ceased talking at one another this afternoon, we invite you all, members of the round table, the media, and members of the public present, we invite you all to the commission offices at 5 o'clock for refreshments, and we hope we can gather there and enjoy ourselves later on today. I should also mention, for the benefit of those of you who didn't arrive for the opening session on Tuesday afternoon, that these objects on the desk in front of me were presented to the commission by Maureen Kelly on behalf of the Pilbara Land Council in Western Australia. And at the coffee break this morning, I'll ask Maureen to explain what they are. And at the coffee break, I know some of you who didn't have a chance to see them would like to come up and examine them. That brings us to the proceedings this morning, and let me just give you one or two brief impressions of my own of yesterday's proceedings. I think we were all interested to hear what Shorty O'Neill and Stan Scrutton had to say about Australia. It is significant, it seems to me, that even though it is only in the last 15 years that the Aboriginal people of that country have begun and pursued their struggle for land rights, it is interesting that they have already developed, at least in the Northern Territory, new forms of land tenure by which native people hold their land in trust for themselves, that is, on their own behalf, a form of holding land tenure that may well be useful to us in our deliberations here. Certainly it deserves to be examined. I was struck by Alf Isaacson Keskitalo's account of the history of Sami land rights, that in the 18th century they had their own self-governing land use councils, the CETAs, and they are now seeking to reestablish some form of self-government for themselves and for the governance of their relations with the government of Norway itself. Dr. Robert Peterson indicated in one or two sentences why the Greenlandic Eskimo have achieved home rule. He said that Greenland is an island, and its climate and its soil have not attracted large numbers of European immigrants, and that has meant that the Eskimos still predominate and thus have achieved home rule on a non-ethnic institutional basis. Yesterday we heard lastly from Mark Gordon, and I think all of us who have been working on this commission were interested in the very careful examination that the Inuit of Northern Quebec made of the Alaskan Native Claims Settlement Act in their negotiations with the Government of Canada, the Government of Quebec, and the James Bay Hydro Corporation, and I was struck by two things that he said about the corporate, the corporation that the two corporations that the Inuit and the Cree have set up in Quebec. One, by the fact that they rejected the idea of a shareholding corporation and opted instead for a perpetual membership corporation. And secondly, by the careful limitations they placed on the powers of investment given to the board of directors of each of those corporations. Well, that brings us to where we adjourned yesterday. And Mark, I think we're still eager to hear from you and have you carry on with your presentation at the point where you left off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to give you a quick rundown of, in general, what were the types of issues that were covered by the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement. There was the provisions protecting land, and these, and also transferring land ownership to our communities. As I said yesterday, the land is held by village corporations that are run membership corporations, much like the McEvee Corp or the regional corporation is set up. There's also just on the land allocations, there's about 243 square miles of land given to each village in ownership.
How many villages?
13 villages. That was at the date of the signing of the agreement. Our villages have a habit of dividing like amoebas and forming new ones. Actually, that's a result of people moving back to their traditional areas, and the population growth in our villages is very fast. So the once there seems to be quite a bit of pressure on the wildlife areas immediately around the villages, they divide up and go back. One faction of the village will go back to their traditional areas. Just to give you an indication of how fast our birth rate is, we got over half of our population is under the age of 12 years old. On the lands, I mentioned yesterday that we were advised by the Alaska corporations that we shouldn't go for the checkerboard effect of land selections. Mm-hmm. And also the lands, we had them all the rights to lands held by the villages. There was also another category of land that was set aside, and that was simply referred to as Category 2 lands, which is basically exclusive hunting areas. There's about 3,500 square miles in total for the whole region that have been set aside for exclusive hunting activities. That means only the Inuit could use these areas for hunting. On the question of the land selections, even though we opted for what seemed to be a better solution than what had been devised here, we found that there was a failing in it as well. If there was any existing mineral interests or any mining interests in that area, we got blocked right out of it. Instead of what happened here, through the checkerboard effect, at least you could have some pieces of land in already proven minerally interested areas, interesting areas. So we got definitely set aside, even though we tried to go for more contiguous pieces of land. At the time, too, when we went into the negotiations, the Quebec government had adopted the Environment Quality Act in Quebec. But at the time we were starting to negotiate, they only had one piece of the legislation was very general. It gave very good goals. It laid out very good goals in the legislation, but there was no regulations. The only regulation that was enforceable at the time was one concerning bottled water sold in the grocery stores. So the evolution of environmental protection and that had just started in Quebec. So when we negotiated the James Bay Agreement, we put in an environmental protection regime which allows special committees to be set up and special hearing procedures for development projects. The protection of subsistence rights was done by through the land provisions giving us exclusive areas and also setting up a special management board. Now, in the area of subsistence or hunting rights, even though we're given some specific provisions, what has really made the difference for us is that the government had never been able to enforce any of their regulations or any of their rules, despite the fact that there was many laws that have been made for the south and telescoped into the north, which were often quite irrelevant. In that area, because we were also assessing the impacts of these projects, what happened was we started putting quite a bit of our money into setting up research and doing biological research work ourselves, setting up our own research groups to study the impacts and also to start assessing exactly what demands we were and what pressures we were putting on the wildlife resources on ourselves. And once we began to have this better...
Well, at least we haven't had an earthquake again.
What we did was we began to get contracts from the government and doing the research work, such as doing biological studies on the whales, on migratory birds in this area. And we had quite a few run-ins with game regulations and things like the International Polar Bear Commission and things like that. We found that the government's regulations were often not based on true biological fact, but just on bureaucratic administration of tags and things like this. They would issue a tag, and they were supposed to tag each polar bear skin that you caught, but the way the village administration and that worked, most people didn't bother getting the tags, and often the sale of polar bear skins were not through formal institutions but done on one-to-one basis. Therefore, the requirement of tags never was really there. I'm just telling you about the polar bear case to give you an example of what we've done. We then went into tried to figure out exactly what the kill statistics were of our people in our area, and we found that they were quite different from what the government had thought they were, actually quite a bit higher. So we told the governments that the basis in which they were putting up quotas for animals like the polar bear had no real scientific basis for the numbers that they were throwing at us. And we recommended that all quotas be lifted until we could come up with the accurate statistics. At that time, the Quebec government was forced to agree with us, and then they went to the Canadian government and told the Canadian government that they had to concede that they could not put in quotas because they didn't have any scientific basis for doing so. The Canadian government then also agreed and went to the International Commission on Polar Bears and made the same representation for our area. About the same time, we then also adopted our own internal rules, very simple rules such as closing the summer months for polar bear hunting, and also not to kill cubs and or bears with cubs. And since we put in these voluntary, because there's no enforcement, these regulations that we set up on our own, all of a sudden the kill statistics stopped fluctuating. And with no enforcement, no outside enforcement, all on a voluntary basis, ever since, that's a good 6 years ago now, ever since that time, we've killed exactly 45 bears in all of northern Quebec, which just happens to be 10 more bears than what the quota that they were offering us. Now, this hasn't been done strictly on the basis of our preferential rights or the rights that we have to the wildlife, but on what has really made the difference was that we did our own research work and also tried to come up with our own regulations. And tried to, when we came up with a problem, such as the polar bear, or in another instance, it was the beluga whales in one particular estuary, we worked out our own regulations that could be followed through voluntarily and much more easy. Those have been much more effective than a government from the outside trying to enforce rules and regulations on us. But here, I think it's because we've taken the interest and tried to follow the rules of the game that the governments use, trying to use scientific means to prove what we're trying to do, that have really made the difference and also established some credibility with the governments on trying to manage wildlife resources. There's also general provisions talking about the regional government, and I talked yesterday about some of the failings of that. Then there was the social and economic provisions. In this, the provisions of the James Bay Agreement dealing with economic benefits and economic programs have never really been implemented up to now. There was also the provisions dealing specifically with the hydro project that gave us some remedial works for the project. And also, of course, there was the monetary provisions that dealt with the compensation funds that we would be receiving.
Could you could you just pause for a minute and tell us what amount of money was involved in the settlement?
There was There's three amounts. There was approximately $90 million was supposed to be received by the Inuit of Northern Quebec. The Crees were supposed to receive more. What happened there was that there was three allotments of funds. There was one that was based on past compensation before the James Bay project. There was a certain amount of money set aside for that, approximately one-third of the funds. Another third of the funds was based on compensation for the James Bay project itself. And then what happened, we had an agreement in principle before we came with the final agreement, and there was one more lot of funds that was supposed to be based on royalties. And the royalty provision that we had gained in the agreement in principle had a life to it. It was only to last something like 25 years. The government found out by the provisions that we had put in, what we did effectively was to lock the government into its existing taxation and royalty laws. They could, once we had agreed with us on a tied formula, they were not going to be able to change their taxation and their royalty laws that they had established for mineral development. And they wanted to see if we could come up with another arrangement after we'd come to the agreement in principle. So what we did was we had an independent assessment done to see what would be the dollar value of keeping a royalty provision as it was. And we found out that it would be, because of the rate of development in our area, it would be better for us to opt out for cash up front, as opposed to a royalty provision that lasted 25 years. So we traded that off and got cash up front. That's one of the criticisms that have been often leveled at us by other native groups, that the fact that we didn't have a royalty provision. The royalty provision that we had gained had a very defined life to it. So the cash value of it was going to be not as great as it sounds, so we opted up for the cash. On general, the economic provisions, and even though that we'd received these funds from the governments and set up the regional corporation and started getting involved in ventures, we set up different subsidiaries such as Erie Inuit, Kiek Construction, Sanak Maintenance, Imakwik Fisheries. Some of them had failed, some of them had made money, much like the situation here. Not all the investments were successful, but a good portion of them. But because of the investment restrictions that we had worked out, Mekivik as a whole has always managed to keep its head just above the black the red line. So we've always managed just to make money. And our initial capital is still intact. We've lived off the interest up to now and been able to set up some ventures. We've lost some money, like I said. In one venture, we lost over $6 million. But the economic impact to the communities and what it has meant to the people in the village level is not, much like here. The success or the tangible benefit to the individuals at the community level have not been visible enough or have not been tangible for the local people. Even though that we've been made we have some very successful businesses and been able to make money, the direct impact to the villages is not as great as it should be. Having all this money, setting up the corporation, allowed us to do, gave us a very good educational tool for ourselves. It taught us a great deal about how Western economies worked, how Western societies, through their corporations, interact with each other. It gave us sort of our bit in the Western economy. But on the ground, it has not had the impact that we had anticipated. The village economies are still basically very traditional economies, and we still have a great deal of unemployment. Our unemployment is around over 60% in all of our communities. It could go as high as 85 and 90% in some of our smaller communities. So, the creation of jobs and having the positive impact of this cash directly to the villages has been very dismal, actually. And this has often created quite a bit of discontentment at the village level. It's the economy that we are often trying to force, or economic, when we talk about economic development, we always seem to hook onto the dollar, the Western scheme of economic development. The economies in our communities, if you take a look at them as traditional economies, our villages are now have the ability to feed themselves. No one's hungry. So in the traditional sense, our villages are probably as wealthy as they had ever been in terms of being able to bring in wildlife resources and to be able to feed themselves. The population is growing. We've been able to maintain this level of harvests, and the wildlife populations have not had any major crashes in any of the species that we harvest. So in that sense, the economy of our people is good in one sense, but in the Western sense, it hasn't really made an impact in the villages. We've been doing some studies ourselves, and we are finding out that in terms of wage employment, The way incentives are given to people to go to work and subsidies that are given to the different people that come up to work, the way what we've been finding is that the local people have the hardest time getting the jobs. Even though now we own and control our own institutions, because of the requirements by regulation of for things like in the construction trade and the trade union laws and things like that, we are still forced to hire more skilled labor from the south than from our own populations. In fact, there are many regulations that force us to do so. We had found in a recent study, because a local person who is hired is given a straight salary and no other subsidies, but white people who are brought in from the south are given perks all over the place. They're given a housing subsidy. So in some institutions, even though they are Inuit controlled and run now, like the hospital corporations, the schools and all that, they are given free housing. They are given a cargo allowance, which allows them to try and beat the high cost of transportation and be able to order food directly from the south. They're given an isolated post allowance over and above this. They're also given free holiday, paid holiday trips to the south with their families. When you total up all of this and calculate the tax-free benefits that they receive, two people working on the same job, one from that village and one imported from the south, on exactly the same job with exactly the same qualifications, the person from the imported labor would earn up to 114% more than the local person because of these hidden benefits and perks. Now, this is not the situation just in northern Quebec as well. I think it's more widespread than most people realize. It's just that we've been able to come up with some more accurate statistics on this thing. There's many areas in the economic development that have failed, and the jobs have not become more available to us, even though we've received control over our institutions. In the construction trade, we've had people that have been working in carpentry for over 25 years. But because they cannot write the exams in French or English, they can't get qualification papers and we are forced to pay them at labor rates. And you have to have certified people to hold the jobs and to be able to have your project, to keep your bonding, as they would say, so that you could qualify as a construction company. These are some of the failings that we had found in trying to bring the economic impact directly to the people at the village level. There's been, right now we're going through a major reassessment of exactly how we can make that better benefit. Having Mekivik has proven and given us the credibility that shows the banks, the governments, that the Inuit people can run Western style institutions, financial institutions, and given us a credibility and accountability that we couldn't have been able to prove otherwise. But on actual benefits to the people, I think is the success there has been not as good as we would want it. And we're doing a major reassessment of exactly which way and how we could best do this now. Even though we've been able to have some very successful companies, we have not been able to bring that the economic impact to the village level. Some of the areas not covered by the James Bay Agreement and not included were also culture and language rights. The priority of Inuit substance over development rights was not adequately covered. And there are also, even though we have areas such as hunting and fishing rights, there's still not enough adequate protections now that we've tried to put it to the test. The James Bay Agreement is quite lengthy and has provisions all through it, and it was also negotiated at the time with the major developers. at the negotiating table was Hydro-Québec, James Bay Development Corporation, James Bay Energy Corporation, the James Bay Municipality, the Quebec government, and the federal government. Now, we'll talk about the feds in a minute, but these were the parties we had to negotiate our native rights and try to establish our form of self-government. When you have that and that many developers at the table, it wasn't directly a negotiation with the government. We also had to satisfy the developers on every provision, so it made the negotiations very tough. In fact, the negotiations and the way the agreement came out, there was one provision that was really negotiated to death. It was only after we had signed the agreement that we found out there was one very long sentence in there that didn't have a verb. So it gives you an idea of how the negotiations went about. The weight of the governments and the resources that they had available to them were very unequal. We had a at the time of the agreement in principle, we had a negotiating team of five people. The government had all its departments, had all these developers, and they had all their lawyers, all the resources available to them. If one person got tired at the table, they could replace them with another 100. They had thousands of these civil servants and technocrats available to them. We had five at the table, and we had to negotiate round the clock with that five. So the type of negotiations, we didn't have the resources to be able to even adequately research what they were throwing at us. After the agreement in principle, our resources improved somewhat. We had about 20 people at the, that we could use for our whole operation. But they could still outnumber us 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1 if they wanted. So the negotiations were never done on an equal basis, far from it. In fact, if we held out too much, we were even blackmailed at times that our funding would be cut off for holding out and being too tough on some provisions. So the process we went through was very lopsided on government's side. While the negotiations were going on, there was the cloud of the court case that hung over us all the time. What had happened was that now that the court case had gone into the Court of Appeal, we didn't think we had a very good chance of winning it in the Court of Appeal. We had won that that Aboriginal rights, we had established the principle that Aboriginal rights and land claims and that had to be settled. We then, at the time of the agreement in principle, we knew that the judgment was coming down very, very soon. So what we did was we signed an agreement in principle as quickly as we could, saying that regardless of what the court outcome of the court case, we will continue with the negotiations and go to the try to get to a final agreement. If we didn't get to the final agreement, then we would have went on to a higher court. But our chances, as we calculated them, were very poor in any event. After we signed the agreement in principle, 1 week later, the judgment came down, and it was against us. If we had followed the route of the courts and not negotiations, Aboriginal rights, land claims would have ended. We would have lost our case, and we wouldn't have received anything at all. So there was quite a bit of duress on the people and quite a bit of pressure to make a negotiated settlement right away. With all of this, one thing we tried to do was to have a provision that allowed the agreement to be amended and to be modernized. Now, from that, we're now trying to go into the process of modernizing it and trying to bring it up to date. The regional government, we are now into the second stage of negotiations. I would also like to say here that there was not 100% agreement on the agreement. There was a faction that evolved and called Inuit Tungavili Nunamini, which is, or ITN, they became an opposition group to the agreement. They could not agree to it. They said that the provisions dealing with the regional government were far too weak, were not sufficient. The land areas, the land protections were not good enough. And particularly the provision that deals with the extinguishment of rights. The evolution of land claims in Canada, one thing that had always come about was if you sign an agreement with the government, they had to extinguish all other existing rights that you had. Now, we tried to tie the provision directly with the land so that the rights that were being extinguished were only the rights directly linked to land. We had to bite the bullet and put that and take that provision in. We had no choice. It was either the project would go on as it is, we would not be able to realign or redefine how governmental services and would be carried out in our villages. We wouldn't have got this new monetary resources to be able to do some of the things that we've been able to accomplish. It was either that or stick out our necks and try to go for the ideological sovereignty that most people like to talk about. So faced with this decision, what we call a dissident group, thought that we should hold out for more. We should not agree at this time. And then there was the other faction, which wanted to go ahead because they wanted to grab what they can now and run with it. Because the situation, if it was left as it was, it was going to become quickly unbearable. Social problems were really developing at an incredible rate in our villages. Racial problems, all of this was coming through. So we held a referendum or a vote in our villages. Of the people that voted, 95% were in agreement with the agreement. The dissidents, they did an interesting maneuvering here. They said that all those who don't vote will be considered dissidents, not necessarily ones that vote no. This way they could increase their numbers. I didn't vote because I thought I was too tied up with the negotiations and I shouldn't make the decision. I had a prejudice. But I wasn't a dissident either. But despite the fact that you include all those people who abstained from voting, you would have still had a big majority. About almost 70% of the people would have wanted the agreement. And the dissident group and ourselves have been, the politics of all has evolved to a point where basically we've been leapfrogging over each other, trying to get this new self-government. They hold out for more. We can't bring them in. We can't get an agreement with them. So. We always try to get an agreement that would encompass all of us. But because of the dissidents and the politics that have evolved around that, we are now in a position to be able to work with the Quebec government and try to go for more autonomy in the area of self-government. So we are now just beginning the process of negotiations to work on that. The other areas that weren't covered in the James Bay Agreement were areas under federal jurisdiction, which meant the waters and the islands off the shores of Quebec. There was also, at the time of the agreement, we did what most Native groups have done. We did one thing wrong. We looked at it as a solution to almost every problem we ever had. And this is often, I've noticed, the approach that many groups have gone. We quickly found out that it doesn't encompass everything that we want to deal with. We also found out that it was impossible for certain things to be able to be covered by the agreement, we needed some constitutional amendments. I'll get into the constitutional discussions later with my comrades here from Canada. There was also the agreement we had was to be carried out or put into force by legislation. Now, if it was strictly the legislature of the Quebec government that would do it, since they still have their sovereignty, they would have been able to change that agreement at any time. We couldn't get constitutional protection for what we had attained, so we went for the next best thing. We had concurring legislation. Federal and provincial governments passed a law at the same time covering the same provisions. And putting the agreement into force. The idea being that if we wanted to make an amendment, or if one of the governments wanted to make an amendment, they would at least have to talk to the other government and try to convince them that the amendment was good. Yeah, if that was to try and get protections that the agreement couldn't be changed unilaterally. And that's to the extent of protection that we could get at that time. There was no such thing as constitutionally protected treaties or anything like this. All there was the constitutional provisions that related to the trusteeship role that the federal government has. So that's the level of protection we tried to attain for our land claims agreement. I think I'll stop here and... After we'll talk more about the constitutional activities later on with the other people here from Canada, because that is another important step in the evolution of land rights and Aboriginal rights. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mark Gordon. Could I ask a couple of questions to start off with? You said that under the settlement, each village received so many square miles of land that's held in fee simple, is it?
Yes.
And that was how much land for each village?
243 square miles.
And 13 villages?
Yes.
Yeah. And then you said that throughout the region there is an exclusive hunting area of 3,500 square miles.
Yes.
That's for the 13 villages in the region.
Yes.
And what about hunting rights over the remainder of the lands in the region?
Okay. On that, we do have preferential rights. We are allowed to hunt year-round. If regulations are supposed to be imposed on our people, there's a long process in which the regulations could be done. First, they must look towards internal native management controls. If these should fail, then you would go the route of regulations, in the sense that you would have enforcement and the rules being legislated or regulations being put down by government. But before they get into that step, what they're supposed to try and do is see if there's some internal native management controls, and that's supposed to be tested to see if how effective it is on a given problem. And so far, even though the government is always wanting to put down regulations, they have this thing, they must have the rules written down, regardless how ineffective they are. We've been able to demonstrate that we can put our own internal systems and not have to worry about the problems of enforcement, because they've been able to do the underground effect that we had intended. So far, the need to go to the next step, to regulations, has never really come to being yet.
Is there a form of guaranteed income for hunters and trappers?
The Crees, this was one of the offers given by the Quebec government after we won the court case. They quickly put out a proposal, and one of the provisions was a guaranteed annual income. The Crees opted for that provision and do have a guaranteed annual income. The Inuit, however, rejected this. We thought that what it would do would be give a great incentive for not working. What we opted for was a hunter support program. And in this program, instead of going out and giving everybody a guaranteed income, we thought that already in place were unemployment insurance and the welfare systems that were already in place were adequate. What we did with the funds was we set it up in a program that is administered by the villages, and we can make our own rules for it. But the general objective of the program is to be able to give assistance to people who are unable to hunt so that they can be able to receive country foods, as we would call it. And also, the funds have been used for different things throughout the villages. In some instances, they've used it to be able to purchase, safety equipment like life jackets or safety flares or things like that, or trail radios, HF radios. And purchase these goods and sell them back to the villagers at a reduced rate. To give you an example of how this has worked, in one village they bought life jackets for everybody, enough for everybody in the village, and then people could go to the local council and buy a life jacket. The person who's administering the program knows everybody in the village, so he'd say, well, you're making a good income, you pay the full price. Another person would come in, he doesn't have a job, he'd say, okay, you get it free. They've also been used in many villages to buy wildlife resources like fish,